This is Joe Stein, and you're listening to Thoughts from Lane Ford Podcast. Welcome, Dr. Yeses, to the podcast. Dr. Yeses is one of the main people in the United States to help with athletic performance, and he's come up with new ways of doing things. So I'm going to let you take it and just talk about your background a little bit.
All right. Well, tough to summarize it real quickly, but in essence, I've been involved in the sports field and doing various things for maybe 60 years. I got started early, mainly through some of the influence of the Soviets, where I had to find out what they were doing because they were so great. And they started in 52 in the Olympics. And everybody typically said, well, they're just using drugs. Well, forget the drugs. Their methods of training were superior. They knew what they were doing. Everything was backed up by science. All the coaches, even some of the coaches, they could run rings around us. There was no question about it. Like, for example, to get a PhD in the Soviet Union at that time took about 20 years. And they did maybe 10 or so or more master's theses, all on the same topic, until I finally got to the end. And when they got their PhD, no one in the world knew more than they knew about that subject. So they were highly advanced. And I started learning some of the things from them. And when I translated some of their material, I found out, wow, this is great stuff, because it was written for their coaches. And even I was in the area of biomechanics, and which was essentially analysis of skill or skill execution. And I was reading some of their analyses of world class, and I'm talking about Olympic level runners. And they would bring out things, well, look at this phase over here. He needs a little bit more improvement in his phase. It's got to be a little bit faster. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, hey, I didn't understand it. You know, here I thought I was an expert on, you know, technique. Found out I was a neophyte. And it took about a year or so before the proverbial light went on, and I kind of understood where they were coming from. They were so far ahead of all we were doing. They could analyze a world-class runner and still find out places where he could be better. See, and since that time, I've learned a little bit, and I can look at, what's his name? Usain Bolt. There are places, he's got many places where he could even be better. And most often we think, well, this is technique and that's it. You can't do anything about it. But anyway, that was the beginning stages. I did a lot with the U.S. and Russia track meets way back when. Knew quite a bit in the track field. Knew a lot of their coaches. Been over there several times. I studied with some of the top people. I arranged exchanges with coaches in the Soviet Union, where the coaches actually sat down in classrooms and learned from them. The Russian professors would actually give an hour or so lecture and, you know, discussion about a particular topic. So it was amazing. Here we thought, well, hey, you know, we're pretty good coaches over here. We go over there and we became students. So that was a good part of it. And since then, I started writing up some of these things that I did. And one of the first books I came out with, well, it wasn't the first, but first major book, Secrets of Soviet Sports Fitness and Training. It could have had a good life, but the company that was ready to release it was overtaken by another company. And then by the time the dust settled, it was too late. But it was going to come out just before the Olympics in 88. But anyway, that's disappointing, but that's how it went. But the first major book that was for coaches was Explosive Running. I did quite a bit in the running area. And in the book, I analyzed all types of runners. It's illustrated with many, many photos, sequential photos taken from high-speed video film. So everything was very clear. In fact, it was shot at one ten-thousandth of a second. So, and that one, and then I got into the area of what's known as specialized strength exercises. Then I developed this area. So along with the running, I came out with these specialized strength exercises for every joint action to improve running. Then I did the same thing in golf and hitting and other sports. So did a lot of writing, did a lot of writing not only of books, but also articles of various journals. I was one of the top writers in Muscle and Fitness magazine. In fact, I had a column there called Kinesiology of Exercise. It later became known as the Training Notebook. But this was, they were great articles. Here's how you do the exercises. These are the muscles involved. This is what you should be aware of. These are the sports that it's good for, and so on. And the magazine did a terrific job of putting the muscles in color, you know, on a body. And it was a well-received article. And that went on for many, many years. In fact, it was the number one article read in Muscle and Fitness, and quite a few other articles in, you know, sports medicine and so on. So since then, I've worked with many athletes. I won't go into how I started with them, but in essence, they read about what I did with the Soviets, and they became interested, and I tried out a few of these ideas on athletes, even professional athletes. Some of the first ones I worked with were professional ball players in baseball. So they saw a great improvement, and then little by little, other athletes heard about it. And so I got to working with many, and I was a professor at Cal State. I've been a professor of biomechanics and kinesiology for over 30-some-odd years. So I did a lot of work with my classes on this and taught them quite a bit and with the athletes and expanded. And then I went to my own practice, which I still do. Where I work with athletes, where I do with technique analysis, prescribe exercises to make them better, then follow their program and make changes as called for. So he goes, you can't just tell somebody, hey, just do this and you're going to become better. I found out that it takes at least a year before you want to expect really significant results. Too often, after I work with an athlete, they get great results very quickly. And they think this is it. I say, no, that's just the beginning. But see, we're so used to accepting just a minor increase and say, this is great. You ask a top weightlifter, how much weight are you lifting? And if they have an increase of 5 kilograms or even 5 pounds a year, this is phenomenal. It could have been 20, but same thing in sports. You know, you can improve your technique. I have yet to meet an athlete who could not be better. Everyone can improve and improve significantly. So I think that kind of covers the waterfront. I don't know if you need anything more, Joe, but I think that's it.
You want to talk about the history of the glute ham and how you kind of got the idea from the Soviet Union?
All right. There are two things here. There's the glute ham, and I called it the glute ham developer in the early stages, and also the exercise, the glute ham gastroc raise. So, you know, most people today, when they do that exercise, they leave out the gastroc, short for gastrocnemius. But they shouldn't. See, but they're doing it incorrectly, but I'm jumping ahead. When I was over in the Soviet Union, I watched many of the Soviet athletes work out. Most of them were weightlifters, but there were a few in other sports, because they were all in these physical education institutes, like coaching institutes. And I saw when they did the hyperextensions that they'd bend the knee a little bit at the end. They'd rise up and bend the knee, rise up, knee bend. So I couldn't figure out why they were doing that. And then I, you know, because of my anatomical background or background in anatomy, I took a look at the muscles. I said, well, yeah, all right, that makes sense. So when they bent the knee and they were under tension, they were developing the lower aspect of the hamstring. The hyperextension developed the upper half. So they were getting both. So I said, now, this is really phenomenal. You're developing a hamstring at the upper end and the lower end, because it's a hamstring is a two-jointed muscle. It has an action at the hip joint, has an action at the knee joint. So doing hypers, you're only getting the hip joint. If you're only doing knee curls, you're only getting the knee curl end or the knee end. But to get both ends contracting at the same time, you needed a full contraction of both ends. Because if you only work in the hip end, there's slack in the knee joint. So that slack's got to be taken up before you get a significant contraction, and vice versa. So I started to develop what I call the glute ham developer. In the Soviet Union, they did the exercises on a pommel horse and wall bars. Well, of course, at that time, we were getting rid of all the wall bars that we had in gyms. Because we were getting gyms with fancy mirrors and good-looking gyms rather than functionality of the exercises. Anyway, I went through many models because we didn't have the pommels, we didn't have the wall bars, so how can you do the exercise? So I made a few drafts. I got some companies working with me. We experimented with one or the other, a larger seat, a smaller seat, different heights, and so on. And I finally came up with a workable model of the glute ham developer. With sorrow, and I don't know how to put it, but there's something in the United States, maybe it's our competitive nature, but all companies like to steal from other companies. If one company has a good idea, they'll steal it, and they'll come out with their own version. So as we came out with the glute ham developer, other companies started copying it. And there was no sense getting it patented, because in the fitness industry, by the time you sue a company, have them deceased and stop making the equipment, they no longer exist. The company folds up and there's nobody to sue. So make a long story short, without the patents, the number of glute hams expanded quite a bit. But recently, I've been talking to several coaches that have come over this country and some that are still there. And other people have asked them about this exercise. They knew nothing about it. They didn't do what they called the glute ham. They were just doing hypers. So this made me realize that I actually developed a new exercise. Not only a new machine, but I created a new exercise. And the exercise, the glute ham gastroc raise, but the way it's being done today, It's really a reverse hyper. Most athletes are not doing it correctly. So they're not getting the benefits. All they're doing by doing it, reverse knee curl. They're just developing only half of the muscle. See, because when you do the knee curl, you have one other muscle, the biceps femoris, that's involved, but it doesn't cross the hip joint. So you're not getting the full development. And it's sad, you know, and I've even brought this out many times. I say, oh, no, this how it's done. But to do it correctly, you got to start in the bottom position, rise up, and then bend the knee. Rise up until you're level to the ground, then bend the knee. And if you do it this way, I'll be able to hear you in the next room. You'll know it when both those ends of the hamstring contract. You're going to let out a pretty good groan. But most people today, they start with the upright position and lower themselves to the level and they come up again. So it's really a reverse knee curl. And it's what everybody's calling, you know, the glute ham. It's not a glute ham. Glute ham raise. All right, you have any questions on that, Joe? I think that covers it.
Yeah. What are some of the athletic benefits that you can get from the glute ham? You kind of touched on that, but from like a running and jumping standpoint and this an athletic standpoint, what are some benefits you might see from it?
Well, it's from the development. The exercise itself is not really used in many sports per se. Like if I want to improve running, I wouldn't do this exercise and expect an increase in running speed. But you strengthen the muscle to help prevent injury. In fact, I can say without exaggeration or whatever you want to call it, I have never had a single athlete who had a hamstring injury. In all my years, in 60 years of working with athletes, I have never experienced a hamstring injury with any of my athletes. And I attribute some of it to this exercise, as well as other exercises, you know, that we did. Where were we?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Tell me about the work you did with plyometrics to bring those over here.
All right. That's another very misunderstood area. I brought plyometrics, or introduced plyometrics, to the United States. I learned everything I knew about it from Dr. Vereshchansky, who created plyometrics. We knew about it over in this country. In fact, Fred Wilt and I, we came up with the term plyometrics. It's really a poor term, as I now know. But it stuck, so this is it. But if the plyometrics that Vereshchansky developed should really be called shock method training, or the HIIT method. The shock method maybe sounds a little better. And the reason for this is that the way he created the plyometrics, it's like it must be an explosive, immediate swishing of the muscles. And this can only be accomplished by, you know, dropping down from a height. This is one way of doing it. There are other ways that I've developed with my active cords, where we can do plyometric exercises. But the way Vereshchansky did it, he'd have someone step down, not jump down, step down from a height. Then immediately upon rebounding or upon landing on the ground, rebound and jump as high as possible back upwards. So this is really the shock method. However, when I introduced plyometrics in the United States, we have our entrepreneurs again. And the entrepreneurs were a great opportunity for coming out with some books and exposure to this new method. But what they came out with was not the shock method, but jump exercises. CBS wasn't the drop down and the leap back up, but that was a form of jumping. And they used jump exercises as plyometrics. So today, most prevalent in the United States are jump exercises. You know, hopping, skipping, jumping, and so on. These are called plyometrics. In fact, it's gotten so bad, if you can believe it, I actually saw written up a plyometric exercise being done underwater, and a plyometric exercise of some other simple exercise. You know, you can't, I think it was a squat, a plyometric squat. There's no way in the world a squat could be plyometric. But this is how it became bastardized. Everybody had their own interpretation. And today, most often, everybody thinks of plyometrics as jump exercises. Plyometrics is not jump exercises. It's the shock method. And this is what we should be doing. But I refer anybody who's interested in this to see my book, Explosive Running. I'm sorry, Explosive Plyometrics. I go into the whole rationale, the physiology behind the shock method and the stretch reflex. Went into detail on all of these, spent a whole chapter on it. Then there were exercises on plyometric or explosive exercises for the upper body, mid body, total body, lower body, and so on. And some very unique exercises with pictures, sequential pictures. All of the pictures that I have in my books were taken from high-speed video film. So we can see everything clearly. So that, you know, if anybody's interested in this area, I strongly recommend that book. And they can get it from my website, DrYeses.com, DOCTOR, for the doctor. Spell it out.
Like a box jump, there's no shock method involved with this. A plain box jump, it might help with power development or something, but there's no shock to it because you're not landing on the ground.
You could. If you use that box, if let's say the box was even 12 inches high, if you step off, land, come back up, this could be a shock method.
Yeah.
But see, most often the boxes are used in a progression of bounce, bounce, bounce. So you get, it's more like, it becomes more analogous to jump exercises, which is still good. Jump exercises play a role. See, like, I use I did it one time. I don't use boxes too often today, but I use the jump exercises as lead up exercises to the shock method. So they play a very important role. Jump exercises are not to be dismissed. See, if I gave the impression that they're were poor or not, not correct. That was erroneous. They do have a role. That's why people who do them still get improvement. But when we talk about plyometrics, it's a shock method that we want to elicit. This gives you the biggest bang for your buck. But it's important to look at various aspects, not only the height from which you drop down, but also the height that you attain coming back up. So both of these play roles. How do you know if you're making progress? It's not just increasing the height of the drop down, but also is the athlete increasing the height of the rebound? If this is not happening, then the height of the jump down or the drop down is incorrect. So there are quite a few variables to it. you know, we're talking about it this way, we're getting a good idea. But for the real fine points, there's much more to it.
When I heard that sprinting is actually the best plyometric because there's actually a vertical force component to sprinting, and then you land with like 3 to 5 times your body weight, and then you have to push it back up. So there is a shock method with sprinting, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. But I wouldn't call it – all right, but let's put it this way. I hate to use the term a shock method. See, sprinting, it's the same thing as a all right, let's put it this way. In sprinting, the foot's in contact with the ground for about a tenth of a second. A little slower, maybe 2/10 of a second. This means that 0.05 of a second is for the landing. 0.05 of a second is for the takeoff. So we try and duplicate this with an exercise. And this is where the shock method came from. See, what Vercenzi was trying to do is, see, duplicate what the athlete does in his sport. They did not want the athlete doing the sport all the time. This leads to burnout and injury. So it's like, what could we do to improve different aspects of the run or jump or whatever it might be without actually doing the total skill? See, this brought about the whole concept of specialized strength exercises. So the depth jump or the shock method was a method used to improve running speed, especially in the sprints. Of course, we're now trying to duplicate the landing and takeoff in running.
I know you have some new stuff like the 1x20 program.
Yeah. it's new, but it's not really new. I've been using this method with my athletes ever since I've been training. And it's based on good physiological and motor learning principles. It wasn't until a couple of people that I work with came out and said, you know, you got to jazz up what you're doing. Right now, what you're doing is just, you know, you spell it all out. How about calling it the 1x20? That sounded great. Sure, let's call it the 1x20. So everybody thinks it's new, but in essence, it's what I've been doing. And what it means is that you do many different exercises for 20, up to 20 repetitions. This means up to about 20 some odd exercises in one training session for up to 20 reps. Now you might say, wow, this is crazy, it's overload. No, it's not. It's actually a moderate intensity program. Athletes do not get as tired. The HIIT method or high intensity training is effective. Sure, you're gonna get stronger and help other activities, but you're limited in what you can do. How many high intensity exercises can you do in one session? 5, 4, 5, or even less. Of course, you're doing up to 3 or more sets. Well, in the 1x20, you only do one set. Because at the beginning, with any athlete or novice athlete, you need a good foundation. You need every joint, every major muscle strengthened. Then you can move on to more high intensity work later. And we've even had collegiate athletes go on a 1x20 program. And it's amazing how much improvement they get but only for one or two cycles. This means going through the whole program for 6 to 8 weeks. See, which shows that they don't have the complete background that they need from a strength and other physical quality aspects. They've been missing a lot right along, and this is one of the reasons why there are so many injuries. There's another thing I should bring up. We've never had any injuries, except for collision injuries or contact injuries. These are unavoidable. But the severity of these injuries can be decreased greatly. But the 1x20 gives you about 15 different benefits. And even though it's surprisingly, many coaches have a hard time wrapping their heads around this, it develops greater strength than a high intensity program. Research has shown that moderate intensity is the best intensity to be working at. So we found not only does the athlete get stronger than any other program, now we're talking about at the beginning, but they also get more muscular endurance, and muscular endurance is probably even more important than muscle strength. Muscle strength does not make a great athlete. The strength must be converted to speed and explosive power. This is where it's functional or usable. There's greater circulation, a greater capillary bed development, stronger ligaments and tendons. All has been backed up. So this is what makes the 1x20 so effective. And it's used mainly at the beginning in some beginning athletes, especially like a high school level athlete. He could stay on this program for up to 2 years. So even though we start off at, you know, up to 20 reps, which means that, you know, let's say you're going all out, it has to be the most you can do. And the athlete only does 15. Great. Keep pushing it. Maybe another couple of weeks, he's up to 20. Another week later, he's up to 25. That's getting a little bit too high now. But if they experience over 20 reps, 2 to 3 times, or 2 or 3 workouts in a row, then we add more resistance and he drops back down. So now we're back down about 15. Then he gradually works up again. Gets over 20 for a few sessions, add more resistance, drops back down. So it's very progressive. And that's why they keep getting these increases. And I know most people were surprised how they can get even better benefits by doing this program than a typical program that they've been on.
Yeah. So is there a lot of, do people see like hypertrophy with that, or how would it help like a fast twitch athlete? Because I know it's a lot of times people think like fast twitch is just like low reps.
Well, fast twitch, then you got to get into more speed. It's got to be more explosive training. Exercise got to be done, you know, faster. But at the beginning, all exercise should be done at a moderate level of speed. You don't want to go too fast. They shouldn't be thinking, you know, fast twitch, slow twitch at this time. You're looking to develop the muscle, overall development. And you're doing both. The slow twitch are involved mostly in slow movement. But even at a moderate rate, with all these reps, you're getting the faster twitch fibers involved. But you go to them specifically later on. You got to develop the base. And don't be concerned which one it is, you know, which fiber it is. You're developing the total muscle. You're getting all these other benefits. You're getting structural and functional benefits. This is what we should be looking at. See, only later do we look for other methods once they get beyond this whole base or foundation.
Before I let you go, is there any other new things that you're working on?
There are quite a few, but hard to explain in a short amount of time. But let me mention one thing, maybe, that I found you can improve the performance of an athlete by duplicating what they do in their skill execution. Now, this doesn't mean duplicating the entire skill. Work has to be very specific, but it doesn't mean the total skill. You can take any joint action. Let's take a runner. I mentioned a runner. Well, let's improve the push-off. This could be done. Okay, what's involved in a push-off? Ankle joint extension. How can I improve ankle joint extension? Do the heel raises. Now, I can do the heel raises. That duplicates what happens in running. But in speed running, it's a very quick ankle extension. So now we have to get into the quickness aspect. And that's where the plyometrics come in. So we can go from strength all the way through to the plyometric side. But what does the athlete need? Once we determine what he needs, then we target it at this time. Let's say the runner has already great speed, but we want to be a little bit faster. All right, so this means we have to get into more of the explosive and then plyometric type exercise. The knee joint in running, it's not involved in a push-off, so we ignore it. But we do need strong quads to keep the body from getting too low. You want to remain high in running. In fact, studies show that world-class sprinters, their center of gravity only deviates about 1 inch. In other words, it's like they're running on a straight line. There's no up and down. So we have to have strong quads to keep us up there. But if your quads are weak, you're going to have a lot of sinking. Then you're going to start looking like a, not a yo-yo, but like you're on a pogo stick. That's severe, of course, but you get the idea. So any joint that needs improvement can be isolated. You work on improving that one joint and then put it into the total joint, total body action or skill, and you have great improvement. So that's my latest endeavor.
Yeah. What's your website again?
Dr. D-O-C-T-O-R, yeses, yessis.com.
Thank you for coming on. It is a big thing for you to come on this podcast. So
you're very welcome. Anytime.